Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Jonathan Haber. He's an educational researcher, writer, and entrepreneur, and we're talking about his new book, Critical Thinking. Jonathan, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thanks, Mark. It's great to be here.
Now, this is part of a series, the MIT Press Essential Knowledge Series, and what I was really impressed about is that it gave me a sort of, first of all, an understanding of the evolution of critical thinking, some of the elements of how you would actually do critical thinking, and then there's a really important section at the end about teaching critical thinking and how we should go about it and how we should evaluate the students in critical thinking. You've written other books on critical thinking, but this really sort of covers an awful lot of different sort of ideas in critical thinking and thoughts about it.
Yeah, well, that's the point of the Essential Knowledge series. It's a series MIT started a few years ago that's meant to take ideas that are interesting but often complicated, often in sort of science and technology, but then more recently in philosophy, and make them accessible to the lay reader, the average reader. So in this case, critical thinking is a subject that lots of people talk about. Obviously, it's a high priority. Educators say, you know, they want students to become critical thinkers. And there's books out there, but most of the books are either textbooks, often used to teach college-level critical thinking courses, or how-to books. And there's nothing wrong with how-to books. I've written one myself, but this book had a different mission as part of the Essential series. This book was designed to explain what the concept of critical thinking actually is, you know, and as well as tackle, I think, some of the most important subjects of critical thinking, whether it can be taught, and if so, how can it be taught and assessed. So in a way, I took the mission, which fits with the Essential Knowledge Series mission, was not to have another how-to book, but to dispel the three key myths that stand in the way of critical thinking being a bigger part of education, a bigger part of our lives, that we don't know what it is, we don't know how to teach it, we don't know how to assess it. All three of those are myths, and that's really what this book was meant to shatter.
Now, the book starts out with sort of an evolution, at least on the philosophy end of it, of critical thinking. You go all the way back to Aristotle in particular, through René Descartes and so on and so forth. But it was when you get to people like John Dewey and Edward Glaser, I think, in 1941, is where a very specific idea of critical thinking sort of develops. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the challenges is people feel that we don't sort of know what critical thinking is. We can't do anything about it until we do. But
well, there are a lot of definitions, as you point out in the book.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when I told people I was writing a book on critical thinking, a lot of them were like, oh, great, you can synthesize these all into one definition or pick a winner. And, you know, it just dawned on me that, you know, we're not missing necessarily a definition. We're missing an agreed upon wording, you know, one agreed upon phrase that everybody could say that defines critical thinking. And it struck me that that was sort of a narrow way to think about sort of a consensus understanding of critical thinking. So I took a genealogical approach and actually tried to discover, like, where did this concept originate that there's this type of thinking, you know, unique from intelligence, unique from wisdom, distinct from other sort of intellectual virtues that we call critical. And, you know, I discovered, even though critical thinking has its roots in ancient philosophy, particularly the work of Aristotle, but also early modern philosophy and science, Descartes, Newton, and then more contemporary fields like psychology, and then most recently cognitive science and modern education theory. But, you know, the concept that there is this thing called critical thinking, or this unique form of critical thinking, as an origin point. It's 1910. Even some of the critical thinking champions I've talked to get sort of surprised at the notion that it hasn't been around forever. But the first instantiation of it, you know, you mentioned John Dewey.
Yeah.
And it was in a book he wrote called How We Think that was published in 1910. In that book, he outlined a concept called reflective thinking, which, you know, ties into many of his philosophical and educational beliefs. But reflective thinking was the first sort of instantiation of this concept of a sort of structured, form of thinking that we could be trained to do, that anybody could be trained to do. In Dewey's case, he was talking about how democratic citizens need to be trained to think in certain ways so they can understand, you know, what's going on and make informed, sensible decisions, something that's obviously still relevant for us today. And so I would say by the time Glaser and subsequent authors were writing about critical thinking, or they sort of replaced reflective with critical, and that's the phrase we've used ever since. But I would say all talk of critical thinking has really been in dialogue with Dewey's original 1910 concept of reflective thinking.
One of the things that was interesting to me is also the importance of, it's not just all happening in your head. You're also explaining, or sometimes debating, these ideas that you've got at through critical thinking to an audience or to a person. So it's not just happening in your head, it's happening in society.
Yeah, I think there's a couple important points in what you bring up that, you know, critical thinking has is often taught in terms of how individuals can think more clearly, can think better, can structure their thinking, and that's all incredibly valuable. But, you know, what they're thinking about is usually something going on in the world, you know, and that might be a political issue, or it might be a news story, it might be an editorial or a political ad or just a regular commercial ad, right? So you're thinking about something in the world, so that means you have to have a set of language skills that's going to take, let's say, an editorial, take the argument in editorial and sort of distill it down into a logical structure that can be analyzed for quality. So you're as a critical thinker, you're interacting with the world. Now, sometimes it's written material, but often it's conversation. So you're having a discussion or debate with somebody else. You're trying to persuade each other to, you know, vote for a particular ballot question, for example, the Massachusetts ballot. Well, you know, that's an example where we have to understand what each other are saying,
right?
So that there's language skills, there's interaction with other humans. But also another important point is that, you know, thinking is not just something that goes on in your head. Thinking is something that may happen between people. It often does happen between people. You know, we're engaged in a dialogue right now. It's an interview, but there's thinking going on,
right,
you know, that's sort of expressed in our conversation. So I think that's an important point. And in fact, that's probably an important area of development for critical thinking, since I think we understand how to make us as individuals better thinkers pretty well. I think creating more kind of critical conversation, I think, is a sort of interesting area of exploration for where critical thinking can go.
Now, part of critical thinking is what you define in the book as information literacy. And this includes things of where and how to locate information, good information, evaluating that information, organizing the information, synthesizing that information, and then finally communicating that information. We all need to be able to do that. I think everybody knows how to locate information. The problem is in the middle part where evaluating information really seems to be the part that's missing for a lot of people.
Yeah, and you know, we should, you know, indicate information literacy is, you know, hat tip to the library field. They really kind of invented the concept of information literacy back in the 70s when they were sort of reinventing their field and becoming information specialists. But I think, you know, we can think of information literacy as just the latest way of making sure that our thinking is based on sound knowledge. In this case, background knowledge is a key critical thinking skill, right, or a critical thinking area, right? You can't have a argument about something you know nothing about, right? You need to know what you're talking about. And traditionally, the information may have come from newspapers, magazines, from the media, you know, in early days, you know, libraries or scholarship, depending on the nature of debate. So we need a sound foundation of background knowledge in order to think about something, right? You can't, it doesn't matter how artful your argument is if your facts are wrong. So now in our modern age, you know, where is our background knowledge likely to come from? Well, it's more likely or not to come from the media or from increasingly from online sources. And so here's where we can really turn to work that, you know, librarians have been developing over the last 50 years on how to not just find information, which, as you said, you know, most of us can locate it, although locating is a skill. Often people stop at, you know, what's on the first page of Google. So there's actually more in-depth work even in the location.
And most of us are susceptible to confirmation bias.
Absolutely, right. So we have to be able to, you know, evaluate the information based on not just the biases of the people creating it, but our own biases, and then put that information to work through the other steps of the information literacy process. So absolutely, I would say, you know, background knowledge has always been a key component of critical thinking, which is why I think any practical approach to critical thinking these days will need to, you know, teach students to master information literacy skills.
Now, obviously, you believe that critical thinking can be taught, but where should we start in the education process, starting to teach the basics of critical thinking? And one of the other things you very clearly bring up in this book is some people think, like, well, we'll do science in the science class, and that involves critical thinking. So that's teaching critical thinking.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is really gets into the notion of, you know, the when and where and how critical thinking should be taught, right? I think, you know.
So where do you think ideally, at what sort of grade level do you think that we could start?
You know, there's doesn't seem to be necessarily a lower level.
Okay.
For teaching critical thinking, there was this interesting project in the UK called Philosophy for Children, where they're engaging grade schoolers in actual philosophical conversations. And, you know, systematic program was studied. And they found that, like, you know, kids' test scores improved, you know, in like, language and math skills, the students who went through this process. So it seems like the notion of kind of structuring your thinking, you know, teaching people to think in a disciplined fashion. There's not necessarily a lower limit to at least introducing kids to the basics. I think, you know, in the sort of middle school and high school years, the sort of adolescence, as anybody who has, you know, adolescent children know, that's when students are already sort of rapidly developing in their abilities to argue. You know, argue positions.
Yep.
You know, sometimes parents can, teachers can find that frustrating. but in fact, there's sort of growth in that area is rapid.
You have to keep telling yourself that in the back of your mind.
Right. It keeps. You know, I'm, as a parent of two teens and young adults, it keeps me sane. But it's also like something you could build on, right? It's something that these skills are real. They're as rapidly developing as motor skills are in you know, very young children. So I think that's an area where you can be teaching some of the core critical thinking skills explicitly.
What about an entirely separate course dedicated to critical thinking?
Well, that's how we teach critical thinking in colleges right now. But many schools, not all of them, many schools.
We could probably do that at the high school level, it seems, too.
We could, but, you know, I think part of the book, as you read, was there was some research into what's the best way to teach critical thinking. And there's sort of three approaches. One is the what's called the general approach, and that's the standalone critical thinking course, whether in college or if we somehow sort of cleared the room to create one in earlier grades in K-12, that would be a standalone course. That's the general approach. But as it turns out, that's not the best way to teach critical thinking. At least, you know, current research indicates there are better ways to do it, that it's better to integrate critical thinking into the teaching of other subjects, which is good news, right? Because it means we don't necessarily need to, like, dump a subject or reconstruct the whole K-12 curriculum. We can keep, you know, the core four, English, math, social studies, and science, but just sort of include critical thinking as part of that instruction. But there's two ways to do it. And one was a way you sort of alluded to before, where you think, well, you know, I'm teaching science, or I'm teaching history, I'm teaching complex subjects, you know, I'm a good teacher, and I'm teaching complex materials. So obviously critical thinking is coming along for the ride.
But shouldn't the teacher themselves should be trained in critical thinking specifically, so that they can do a better job at it? In other words, I think one of the things I got out of reading your book is that there are teachers who are going, because I'm teaching science, I'm teaching critical thinking, without then trying to do more in that realm.
This is exactly where, you know, the sort of slight but important changes can make all the difference, right? Mm-hmm. What teachers are current, when a teacher says, you know, I'm teaching science, the scientific method, or I'm teaching, you know, geometric proofs, and so therefore I'm teaching critical thinking, they're using what's called an immersion approach, which is essentially osmosis. You know, critical thinking is coming along for the ride when I teach these complex topics. But if you ask any students, okay, you know, so you've just, you know, learned inductive reasoning, or what's the difference between inductive and inductive reasoning, both they and probably many of their teachers wouldn't be able to explain that the geometric proofs are an example of deductive reasoning and the scientific method is inductive, right? In other words, they're not learning the content of what it means to be a critical thinker. They're not learning logical thinking. They're not given opportunities to practice translating, whether it's scientific papers or newspaper editorials, into critical thinking, into argumentative statements, you know, premises, inclusion of argument. They're not learning the explicit content. And, you know, critical thinking is a set of explicit content that should be taught explicitly. And that's the trick. That's called the infusion approach, where rather than just assuming critical thinking is coming along for the ride, you include it in a lesson, but you include it explicitly. You know, so the science teacher who stops and explains, okay, you know, that we've just engaged in an informal argument over, you know, genetic modification or global warming. Let me explain to you what that is. So the math teacher teaching geometric proofs and saying, okay, this is an example of deductive reasoning. Let me explain to you what that is. You know, so it's just, it's a subtle change, but it's an important one. And that's, you know, if we're doing sort of the general approach in college to teach critical thinking to some students, we're doing the immersion approach for basically all students in K-12. And then we're wondering why students aren't sort of becoming critical thinkers. Well, they haven't been trained to learn the skills, because teachers aren't trained to teach them through the more effective method.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Jonathan Haber. He's an educational researcher, writer, entrepreneur. And we're talking about his new book, Critical Thinking. It's out on the MIT Press Essential Knowledge Series. It's a really fine book that really is available to everybody, I think. I want to talk about, there's a list here of the attributes of a critical thinker, and I just wanted you to comment on each one. Intellectual humility, that seems to be a problem right now for a lot of people. But intellectual humility, explain why that's important.
Yeah, these are what are called intellectual dispositions that most critical thinking educators, we talked about a definition before, and while it may not be a explicit wording, there is a general understanding that to be a critical thinker, you need a certain amount of knowledge, you need a certain amount of skills. We also need certain dispositions. And one example is intellectual humility, which is, you know, not assuming you know everything, right? Sort of understanding you might be wrong.
That's so important.
But it's valuable in, you know, in many, even about something that you turn out to be right about, right? If you assume you might be wrong, that means you're ready to challenge your beliefs with arguments. You're ready to not just put the beliefs of somebody who disagrees with you to the test. You're ready to put your own beliefs to the test. And what's the result of that? Well, either you're going to discover something you believe might be incorrect, you know, and that means you might gulp, change your mind, which should be considered a sign of strength, not weakness. Or you might discover that your opinions are justified, you know, and that makes you believe them for good reasons versus just, you know, you refuse to not believe them. And it makes it more likely you can convince other people that your beliefs are true. You know, so intellectual humility is not just about kind of being wishy-washy and assuming that, you know, oh, I might always be wrong. I can't argue my case. It just means being able to challenge your own beliefs with the same vigor that you're ready to challenge other people's.
I won't go over the whole list because we don't have the time, but intellectual autonomy is really interesting because you really need, and this is not something that a lot of people can do, to think for yourself while maintaining control over your own reasoning. I think that's a very difficult thing to learn.
You know, it's all these are challenges, but, you know, in a way, these are sort of like intellectual virtues, and virtues are always hard to learn because we can all claim to know what they are, you know, but to internalize them is a challenge. But, you know, one way to think about intellectual autonomy is, we mentioned Dewey before. Dewey was sort of tapping into an earlier philosophy, pragmatism. You know, I talk about it in the book. But, you know, that philosophy goes back to a philosopher called Charles Saunders Peirce, who identified different ways we form our beliefs, right? And there's a lot of ways we could form our beliefs that aren't very good about getting to the truth, right? We could, for instance, believe what we've always believed. You know, we now call that confirmation bias, you know, but it's also referred to as a priori thinking, right?
Anything
that makes us comfortable because we already believe it, that's probably true. And anything that makes us uncomfortable, we're going to question it, okay? Or we could just go on authority, right? You know, whether it's a priesthood or, you know, scientists or, you know, what the science says or norms, societal norms, right? We could just sort of follow and kind of believe what we're told by authority figures, or we could defy authority. That's called tenacity, right? We could just sort of, whatever authority says, we believe the opposite. And all those are ways of forming beliefs. And there's, you know, there's a time and a place for them. You know, there's a time and a place to believe authority. Like, you know, if you're a parent of a young child, you work with authority, but there's also time to resist it. But none of them are particularly great at getting to the truth. And that's what critical thinking is all about. You know, so it's owning. So really, in that case, intellectual autonomy is owning, taking responsibility for belief formation that you could justify yourself, that you take ownership. You don't outsource your beliefs to, you know, the government or a priesthood or, you know, even, you know, science, you know, right? These are all areas that are human sort of
yep.
creations, and you have a responsibility to sort of think about them and make wise choices as to what you're going to believe.
At the very end of the list is one of the most important ones to me. It's confidence in reason. The idea that over time, everyone is best served by adherence to reason as the best means to gain knowledge and find solutions to problems. It seems we have a breakdown in that in this country.
Absolutely. And I should note that the particular list you're reading from is from a wonderful group called the Critical Thinking Foundation out of California. There's other lists of dispositions, and they all kind of boil down to the same things. But just want to give a tip of the hat to those guys because they've been working in this area a long time. But, yeah, I mean, confidence in reason is, I just listed other things you can have confidence in to form your beliefs, right? You could have confidence that the government is telling you the truth, right? That's kind of gone out of fashion over the last 50 years, but that's, you know, certainly has been a source of belief. Or, you know, you can turn to science, right? You know, what does the science teach us? And then there are times, particularly in our very complex world, we do have to turn to others for information, you know, and for arguments. But it's our responsibility to evaluate that information and understand those arguments, right? And how do you do that? How do you understand when a government report or a scientific study or a news report or even, you know, a talk given at a sermon given at church, how do you kind of understand, the sort of quality of this and how much you should sort of buy into and believe it? Well, you have to reason it through. You have to think it through. You need the critical thinker's tool set, right? So you need to have faith and reason, even if you're like evaluating things that might not have an obvious correct answer, right? You know, something that's going to happen far into the future, something that might involve having to understand what other people are thinking, right? Something we can't have direct knowledge of. This is what critical thinking is good for, right? To answer questions about something where it's not just a question of like truth and falsehood. We can't fact check the future, right? You know, we need a tool set to sort of like, you know, evaluate arguments about what we should do in the future. And, you know, there's one way of doing that, and that's through the quality of reason. So we need to have sort of faith that reason will get us through. You know, it doesn't mean we have to turn Earth into planet Vulcan, right? There's still plenty of room for kind of emotion, human connection, even faith, okay? But I think we just have to understand the important role reason is going to play in those situations where we have to make decisions.
We're almost completely out of time. We've barely talked about this book. We've just scratched the surface. I want to mention, for people who are listening to debates, for instance, there's a great section on recognizing fallacies and bad arguments. And there's a list of things that are fairly well known. If you've ever taken a philosophy course, you probably know these things like ad hominem arguments and straw man fallacies and so on and so forth. What's interesting is how much rhetoric is emphasized in learning critical thinking, like communicating. Because the one thing I worry about, maybe you're a great communicator, but you're communicating bad information. And that certainly happens. There are people who are great communicators, but they're not communicating critical thinking information.
Yeah, you know, actually, if people are sort of interested in kind of seeing some of this in action, I've got a site I've created for the election season called Logic Check, logiccheck.net.
Oh, wow. Okay, give that out again.
It's logiccheck.net.
Okay.
And it actually has, like, you know, analyses of campaign commercials, presidential speeches, newspaper editorials, all based on different critical thinking principles that you just listed. So
Jonathan, we're gonna have to end there. We're completely out of time.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
I feel like I just barely scratched this. There's so much in this book. And it's funny. It's a deceptively small book, too. And it seems like it's small, but there's some huge ideas in this book. My guest tonight is Jonathan Haber. He's an educational researcher, writer, and entrepreneur, and we're talking about his new book. Please pick it up and read it. Critical Thinking. Jonathan, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, great talking to you, Mark, and good luck with all your work.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.